You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Faith. Hefaga nei, coming up on the show for Dear Science this week, our expert Dr. Kushla McGovern chats with us about early human subspecies Denisovan, plants having a second set of roots, and farming sea spiders. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Tom Rutherford, I ask about plans to scrap the nationwide census and concerns from statisticians around the decision. I also speak to Associate Professor of Politics at the University of Victoria, Dr. Lara Greaves, about how the census changes could impact Māori and issues around data sovereignty and surveillance. Faith, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to researcher Nush Herman from the co-created Ageing Research Centre about why we should normalise having older adults in the workplace.
He aha, or whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Or why mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e wareware e ahana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And for Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. Good afternoon.
Kia ora.
And we've got lots of science planned for today, starting with a name I struggled to pronounce. Did I get it quite right?
Yeah, no, you did quite
Denisovan?
Well.
Denisovan?
Denisovan, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd never heard of these before. Early human subspecies, but one of the least discussed ones.
Yeah, because there's not really a lot of fossil evidence for it, right? And it's quite a fascinating story. So we're starting off with the dragon man skull, which was this skull itself. It's got quite a massive cranium, and it's got quite an interesting story in itself. And it's a recent study has come out that kind of indicates that this skull actually is Denisovian. So if we go back to the dragon man skull, and the story is that in 1933, it was discovered by a labourer in working on a bridge building project in Harbin in China for a Japanese-aligned railway project. So 1933, not all great in the world. And a few years earlier, a fossil called the Peking Man had been found, and it had created a lot of media and stuff. And so the story is that he recognised that this was significant, and so he hid it away from the authorities in this abandoned well. Oh. Then 1945, the war ended, the Japanese occupation ended, but he wanted to hide his links with the Japanese imperialists, so he didn't report the skull.
Leaving it even further.
Yeah, right. He just left it there. And so as the story goes, up until, 2018, then he told his grandkids about it, and one grandson went and found this. And then somehow someone at the university must have heard about it, like that bit of the story is not very clear, and this grandson was persuaded to donate it to the Harbin Geo University, where it's since lived.
Yeah.
And so what so people who study early humans are called paleoanthropologists, and there was this group at this Harbin Geo University who studied the skull. Now, because it's got this bit of this history, this story. They didn't find it, so they weren't really absolutely sure where it came from.
Not quite verifiable. Yeah.
Exactly, right? So what they first did was they went to this area and they found some other mammal fossils. And so they've used these mammal fossils and the skull, and they've basically tested the elemental distribution. So what sort of, as you know, has it got copper, lead, these sorts of things. Looked at rare earth elements and their concentrations and stable isotopes. And it's basically to a chemical fingerprint, right? And so they want to compare these and are they similar?
Yeah, verify the location.
Exactly. Yeah. And everything was consistent. Yeah, it kind of came from this area. And then they've used uranium dating to figure out how old it is and found out it's about 146,000 years ago that it was, this being was alive.
Yeah.
And so then they studied its morphology, like the shape of the skull and everything, and they decided, okay, we have a new early hominin, so an early human. And they called it Homo longi. And this was in 2021. And they, some of the stuff I read, there was a bit of controversy around it because it is just one skull and everything.
Yeah,
but
not like conclusive evidence for a whole group, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's where, oh, yeah, so that's kind of where we get to the story of the Dragon Man at that point. It actually turns out that one of the authors of that paper, who was one of the paleoanthropologists who studied this, he doesn't really believe the grandson story of how this fossil was found.
Yeah.
He actually thinks the grandson found it, didn't tell the authorities, but then it's kind of got found out anyway, so then kind of fabricated the story.
Some family drama, right.
So I find that quite fascinating, you know. It's a human element to the story of humans. Right, so we've got this skull. So now we're going to flip to another thread of the story where we go back to 2008 and we're in Russia, of all places, in Serbia. And we've got a group of Russian archaeologists looking in this cave called the Denisova Cave.
Yeah.
Name That's, rings a bell,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I've heard that name before.
It's a Russian, it's definitely a very Russian Slavic name.
Right, yeah. And so these cave systems were quite known for being a good source of early human artifacts and stuff like this. And what they found was just a really small finger bone, which they were then, another group was able to actually sequence a mitochondrial DNA from it and figure out that it was a juvenile female and that it belonged to this new subpopulation of early humans called Denisovans.
Wow.
And so that was just this one little finger bone.
Just this one finger bone. And we found a whole subspecies off of it. Now, I'm guessing we've got a link between these two cases.
Yes, we do, right? So we're getting there. So since then, I think that I've found that there have been seven more instances of these Denisovans, but we really don't know much about them. And so that one of these researchers that was involved with this ancient DNA study on this finger bone got permission to look at the dragon man skull. And so, obviously, she was determined to try and find some DNA. So she looked in the teeth and some really dense bone that's just by your inner ear, because this is hard material, so DNA could survive. And she found nothing. No DNA material. Okay, what's next? Okay, well, let's look at the proteins, because proteins are a bit hardier than DNA. They might survive a bit better. DNA codes for proteins, so proteins might give us some genetic information. And she was able to, well, she and her group, obviously it's not one person doing all this work, found 95 proteins, and four of those types of proteins were known to differ between Denisovans and other hominins based on these other fossils they'd found. And three of these proteins had variants that were the same as Denisovans. So it's kind of some evidence to
some similarities there.
Exactly. But she really wanted DNA.
Yeah, some conclusive evidence. Yeah, okay.
So one last try. So she went, the group went and looked at dental plaque on the remaining tooth.
Wow.
So if you've ever not gone to the dentist for a while, right, and then you've got to get your teeth cleaned and it's quite painful, right, because the plaques, they're trying to get that all off. It's really hard stuff. Like, it sticks there. But it's full of bacterial DNA. Not so often that it's the human DNA in there. But so looked at it and actually managed to find some human DNA that was of the right age, because of course the DNA that they're interested in needs to be old. It needs to be
The same from the same time period.
Exactly right. Because you think about it, this skull has been picked up and handled by a bunch of people who probably weren't thinking about DNA profiling. Yeah,
especially back then, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And so there was a lot of contamination with just human DNA that they have ways of saying that it's more modern. And so of the DNA that they were in, okay, this is ancient DNA, there were 27 gene variants they were able to identify, seven of which actually matched the seven known Denisovans. So they've taken this as pretty good evidence that this is an example of Denisovan. So now we know what they kind of looked like. They had wide faces, they had prominent brow ridges that we commonly associate with early hominins or early human subspecies, but delicate cheekbones, which are more modern traits. And now we know that they actually had a much wider range than we initially thought.
Very interesting stuff. And this next story, plants, roots, there's two? I don't even understand what's going on here, right?
Yeah, no, it was quite a eye-catching headline and a really good pun about we have a shallow understanding.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah.
Of how much we know about plant roots. So a traditional theory of plant roots and how I thought about them was you have the plant grows above the ground, it puts its roots down. As you go deeper, you're just going to get less and less roots, right?
Yeah.
And so this is pretty common traditional sort of way of looking at it. And what this study did was they actually had access to 44 sites around the world across different climate zones and ecological niches, so from like tundra to rainforest. And they actually had soil that went down 1.8 meters, which is the key. And so what they did was they basically would take sections with depth and then look at how much root mass was in them. In that. And so you could basically get a depth profile of how much plant root was in that depth.
Yeah, yeah.
And for 20% of the sites that they were looking at, what they actually found was, yeah, you'd get a lot of root mass closer to the surface, but then you went deeper down, like below a meter, and there'd suddenly be another
clump. Yeah,
exactly.
Interesting.
Right? And so it's this idea that, yeah, the plants, like one in five plants are kind of putting down the second sort of set of roots that are much deeper so they can get to, you know, nitrogen-rich soil and stuff. And
yeah.
So the idea is that probably most of their resources are coming from the surface, but if they need to, then they can tap it.
Might be able to escape, like, the other plants will be taking their nutrients from the more shallow soil so they can get down to the less tapped stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And then it has implications for climate modelling and how we use carbon. Soil as a carbon storage and such. But plants, right?
I mean, you'd think we'd have solved plants by now, right?
Yeah, and there was a comment from a researcher who did actually mention that this isn't a new idea. It's just kind of the first time that the data or the samples have been there for use to study.
Yeah, and then this last story, sea spider farming.
Okay, so I realised as you said it earlier, My title was a little bit misleading. So these are sea spiders that farm.
Right. Okay.
Not us farming
them. What are they farming?
The bacteria on their backs.
Bacteria. Yeah. Sorry, I had to. Oh, God.
So in the Earth's ocean, you'll get sites that are called methane seeps, and it's basically a break in the Earth's crust where you get methane bubbling up. And around these areas, you'll get basically microbial ecosystems, and these are microbes that can use the methane as their food source. And so what you do find a lot of life around these. So, they've found mussels, worms and sponges at these sites. And basically what these things do is they eat the chemosynthetic bacteria. So chemosynthetic just meaning that these are bacteria that use a chemical to eat, like sort of methane. And they're using that methane that's coming up through the Earth's crust as their food source. But what they noticed in these areas is there's lots and lots and lots of sea spiders. And they're like, well, okay, the sea spider, there's too many for them to be just eating the mussels and the worms, and like their gut doesn't really imply that they're preying on them. So what the heck are they eating?
Yeah, it's like when you see a large population of humans in a place and you're like, oh, what are all these people eating?
Yeah, exactly. And so they're kind of like, okay, let's investigate. So they had access to remote operated vehicles of the submersible kinds, and then they also had Alvin submersibles, which are the ones people go down in, and they were able to collect up some sea spiders and bring them up to their research vessel without killing them. So you've got to play with pressure and all this. Not as easy as just bringing them back up. And so what they did first was they basically mapped the bacteria that are on the exoskeleton of the spider, so on its back. And so they use things like what's called metagenomic sequencing. So this is just looking at DNA and RNA all together and sequencing it. Something else called 16S RNA, ribosomal RNA sequencing, which is it's more specific to the bacteria. And then another method called fluorescence in situ hybridization, again, specific to the bacteria. So they just want to see what types of bacteria there. And so there's a bunch of different types, but what they found was that three families were the majority. And these families were methentrophic and methyltrophic. So what all that means is that those bacteria either use methane as a carbon source, basically their food source, or methyls, which are just molecules that have one carbon. So that's methane, methanol, those sort of things.
Right. So similar food sources.
Exactly. And so there's all these bacteria on there. Then they also used electron and nanoscale imaging to look at the the exoskeleton surface a bit more, and what they found was that they were kind of like, they described them as volcano-shaped clumps of these bacteria that were basically embedded in extra polymeric substance. So this just means it was a biofilm, right? Those bacteria were sticking to the back. Yeah. They weren't just falling off. So, okay, so there's all these bacteria on these soy spiders. Who cares? What's going on?
Yeah.
So because they managed to keep them alive and had them on the ship, what they were able to do was obviously feed them.
Yeah.
So they gave them methane in one experiment or methanol in another experiment. But what they did is they replaced the carbon from being carbon-12 to carbon-13. So it's heavy carbon. It's an isotope of carbon that's not very common in nature. So what you can do is you can basically track it, right? Mm. And so you feed this into the system where the sea spiders are that have the bacteria on their back. Leave it for 5 days and see what happens.
Follow it around. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. How do they feed them? I was going to say, I'm just imagining them sprinkling it in like fish food. Or do they gas?
It's probably just some gas. Pumped through the water kind of thing. I didn't actually read it, but I imagine it's kind of like mimicking the actual methane seep where you're just having the methane gas bubbling up into the water.
Interesting.
Then they tested the bacteria and the extra polymeric substance layer on the spiders and found it was carbon rich. C13, so this heavy carbon. They looked at the chitin, which is the exoskeleton material on the spider. It wasn't heavy carbon rich, but the epithelium the cells in the gut of the spider were heavy carbon rich. So, you know, like these spiders had to be getting this heavy carbon into them from the bacteria, right? And then with the imaging, what they'd actually seen was there were some areas that looked like they'd been scraped, right? So the spiders basically toddles along, but hungry, scrape it back,
have a feed. Just like a food stash.
I just had to Google
them
right now because I've never actually heard of sea spiders. And
I hadn't either.
Wow, I would not like to be swimming or diving and seeing one of those.
Yeah, not something an arachnophobe should probably be looking up before bedtime kind of thing.
That's incredible, right? It's like bring along a little food stash with you. I mean, everyone can relate to that sort of. And now we're imagining, you know, these guys are creating the farm themselves.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
That's pretty cool.
Actually, yeah, they've got quite long legs. No wonder they can just reach over and scratch their backs.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. All right. Well, thank you for sharing these science stories with us. This prehistoric type of human, these plant roots and sea spiders making their own farms. I mean, this is amazing stuff that you can only catch here on Dear Science, the pinnacle of science news. All right. Thank you, Kushla, for coming in this week. Thank you, Moshat. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
The Auckland Philharmonia is doing another performance of that famous guy's music.
Who?
You know that guy? Ba 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 ba, ba 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 ba, ba 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 ba, ba ba.
Oh, he looks kind of grumpy in that painting.
Beethoven!
The Auckland Philharmonia plays Beethoven's iconic Fifth Symphony at the Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, June 25th at 6:30. For tickets and more info, go to aucklandphil.nz.
Auckland Museum presents live at the museum with the legendary lineup Shefu and the Crepes, Le'au and Geneva AM this Friday.
And celebrate the sounds on Tamaki's very own doorstep.
Live at the museum with Shefu and the Crepes, Le'au and Geneva AM. This Friday starting at 7:30 p.m. Get your tickets now from AucklandMuseum.com.
95BFM presents B-Sides, a shiny new web series featuring local artists performing two of their own songs and one Kiwi cover.
Hosted by legend Tuva Clifton, Season 1 features Phoebe Rings, Soft Bait, Emily Bateman, Jim Nothing, Babe Martin, and Eliza.
B-Sides! New episode dropping every second Wednesday. Watch it now on the 95BFM YouTube channel.
Ow, my back!
What happened?
I slept on the floor.
Why?
I don't know how to wake up on the right side of the bed. Is it my right side or my left side?
Always wake up on the right side with the 95BFM Wake Up Call. Good morning.
Tune in at 7:25 on Breakfast for your chance to win a voucher for 6 coffees, thanks to Atomic. Just text the word Atomic and your B-card number to 5395 to go in the draw.
The 95BFM wake-up call, thanks to Atomic Coffee Roasters.
I'm not gonna die on this hill, or maybe I will. Summer's over, it's sad, but I'm still been in bed. Can't keep calling it grief, or hoping it's brief when you live in the world. But I live underneath, who will water the plants? Are they just gonna be another thing that dies from spending time around me? I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag. Me, you said, as you lay on my bed, and I haven't been back, cause I'm scared I might crack. I'm a million girls, and a few want to kill, but the others are sweet, so I'll probably be still. You said you're not feeling me, who gave you the nerve? Said you're not feeling free, like I'm caging a bird. I got heartbreak for jet lag. And you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag. And you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag. And you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag. And you got free. Me holding you when you cried, or driving you to the nurse when your body was fried. I was a healer for you if anything went wrong, but you're not broken now, so you wanna move on. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you
got
free. I got heartbreak for jet lag.
It's time for our weekly catch up with National MP Tom Rutherford.
Welcome back to The Wire. Last week, Statistics Minister Shane Betty announced plans to scrap the nationwide census moving forward. The census is the largest statistical survey done in Aotearoa and provides the bulk of population data used in research and decision-making. Betty says the census is no longer financially viable and will be replaced with a combination of smaller annual surveys and administrative data. While the change can look good on paper, there are concerns around how the change in data collection could affect representation of marginalised and minority groups. Census data tends to be more protected from bias than administrative data in smaller surveys, meaning there are more opportunities for misrepresentation. Some statisticians are particularly concerned around the potential exclusion of marginalised rural communities. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Tom Rutherford, I asked him about the census decision and its implications on marginalised and minority groups. So I wanted to talk about the government's recent decisions to scrap the census moving forward. What's the rationale behind this decision?
Yeah, we're modernising the census, replacing the traditionally paper-based census and increasing the frequency and quality of economic data to support the government's growth agenda. A nationwide census day is old-fashioned and outdated, and it's no longer financially sustainable. With escalating costs and successive censuses which have faced problems or failed to meet expectations. So from 2030, New Zealand will instead use government records, a smaller yearly survey, and targeted data collection. We're also going to deliver a monthly Consumers Price Index, or CPI, from 2027. Currently it's quarterly, and we're bringing that to monthly so that we can bring New Zealand into line with other advanced economies from around the world.
Yeah, you mentioned administrative issues with previous recent censuses as a reason for cutting the census moving forward. Is this throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and could other changes be made to the model to make it more sustainable moving into the future?
Yeah, in 2013, the census cost $104 million. In 2023, our most recent census, costs had risen astronomically to $325 million, so over tripled in 10 years. And the next census was expected to come in at about $400 million. Across the world, the way people use data is changing. For more than a decade, Stats New Zealand has been exploring and making better use of information already collected by the data, known as administrative data. And admin data is information that's already collected by government agencies during their everyday operations. Think of organisations such as ACC with their injury claims, student loan and allowances through IRD, Ministry of Social Development, tax and income through the IRD, births, deaths and marriages through the DIA, and education data from the Ministry of Education. So Stats New Zealand will work closely with those organisations to ensure smaller population groups are accurately represented.
Yeah, you mentioned rising costs of the census. If we look at similar countries to Aotearoa, I mean, the United Kingdom, their census in 2021 cost around £900 million. Is it to be expected that the cost would have risen due to rising population and rising needs in Aotearoa?
Oh, I think naturally over time, costs of things do gradually increase. Of course, we understand that. That's how inflation works. But we're not prepared to sit and watch the cost of a census triple over the space of 10 years. As I said, 2013 it was $104 million. Most recent one in 2023 was $325 million. We're just not prepared to sit and watch that cost escalate for our government books. So we're being financially sensible, making decisions to bring the census into the modern age and making these changes, which, you know, if you think about it, census has been traditionally paper-based, sort of a bit of an old-fashioned and out-of-date way to operate. And so what we're doing is we're bringing it into the 21st century, bringing it into 2025 and 2030 for when the next one will take place.
You mentioned the things we're using to replace the existing census, the use of administrative data from government departments and the use of smaller annual surveys. Are there worries that these data collection, you know, whilst useful for smaller scale information gathering, will they be sufficient for accurate data collection around the population and societal demographics?
Yeah, that's a great question. So admin data is already used regularly to produce some statistics, such as population estimates and statistics about international poverty, for example. It's also been used in the two most recent censuses to support the information gathered through the surveying. So we're simply just ramping that up and say that is going to really, really assist us in what we're going to be doing every year from 2030 and beyond.
There's also concerns that the use of smaller survey and administrative data could expose these data collection processes to more biases than the census data would have been exposed to. Is this a concern that the government is keeping in mind?
Definitely keeping it in mind, but wouldn't say that is possibly going to be something that is going to take place. We understand often censuses are about trying to reach the hardest to reach people and to get information from them so that we can get a greater understanding of what our country is and who our country is made up of and everybody in New Zealand. And that's absolutely going to be the focus from 2030, where we move to instead use our government records and a smaller yearly survey and targeted data collection.
Yeah, and on those harder-to-reach communities, you know, some of these communities, especially marginalised groups and rural communities, might go through government services less frequently or be forgotten in annual surveys. Is the government taking additional measures to ensure that these communities remain represented?
Absolutely. So as I said, through the admin data and the information we already gain and information we already get from people through government agencies, we will be ensuring that we make sure we get a very clear picture of the makeup of New Zealand and the people who live here, and so that we've got the government has the clear information about who is in our community and everybody here, so that we can ensure we're making the best decisions we possibly can with the most informed information possible as well.
There's also further concerns regarding marginalised communities and the use of administrative data particularly. Often when marginalised groups are seen in government data, it's when people are sick and struggling, such as in hospitals, welfare systems or the justice system. Are there measures in place to ensure a more holistic picture of these communities?
Yeah, so as I said, some of the admin data that we're already collecting through government agencies aren't just in those spaces that you just identified. They're also through other areas, things such as student loans and allowances and through the Ministry of Education, whether people are in university or going through school or early child education, for example. Then things through like births, deaths and marriages in the Department of Internal Affairs as well. Whether it's your tax income that you pay through the IRD. Obviously, everybody who earns a salary in New Zealand and pays PAYE, well, that information goes through the IRD as well, so we'll be able to collate and collect that information as well. And then information, of course, that we get through organisations like the Ministry of Social Development, so for people who receive, whether it's child support or job seeker benefit or whatever it may be, we'll be able to collate that information as well.
I mentioned the UK census earlier. The UK has actually gone through a similar situation to this, where statisticians in the UK expressed concern when their government proposed a similar change, leading to a final decision to stick with the traditional census model. What's the difference here in Aotearoa, and what would you say to statisticians here with similar concerns?
Yeah, I'd say, firstly, New Zealand isn't the UK, so the UK situation is very different to what we have here in New Zealand with our population of 5 million or so people. What we're also saying is that we're modernising the census. We're replacing the traditional paper-based census and increasing the quality and frequency of economic data to support our growth agenda. And one of the big changes, which I only touched on at the start, but is about that change of moving to a monthly CPI as well from 2027. This will provide more timely inflation data to help the government and Reserve Bank respond quickly to cost of living pressures and support Kiwis in a fast-changing environment. And I think that is a really, really positive change from this announcement.
That was the National Party's Tom Rutherford speaking about plans to scrap the nationwide census and the potential impact on marginalised communities.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Tom Rutherford.
This is why we should never put celebrities in charge of any... Oh, wait.
The Wire.
As discussed, the census changes raise concerns around gathering data on marginalised groups and communities. Lower sample sizes and differences in the method of data collection can expose the data to biases and could lead to poor representation of said communities. The collection and use of administrative data also raises concerns around data sovereignty and increased state surveillance. To discuss these concerns, I spoke to Associate Professor of Politics at Victoria University and Senior Research Fellow in the Faculty of Statistics at the University of Auckland, Dr. Lara Greaves. So today we're talking about cuts to the census. There's been several reasons given by the government for these cuts, particularly around cost and also in assurances that replacement data collection methods will be adequate. One concern that's come up is that while the census is a nationwide survey, these smaller surveys and administrative data can only capture a portion of the population. What are the groups that are being left out?
So basically what the census is it's a survey of everyone in the country. And traditionally it hasn't actually gotten everyone in the country. We know that Māori have been less likely to fill it out. The census has been less good at reaching out to them and finding them and meeting them in ways that suit them, really. And different sort of migrant and Pacifica groups, the census hasn't been so good at reaching in the past. So now what we're seeing is we're seeing this cut to that face-to-face, you know, that online, that enumerate, or what we call an enumerated census. So that's going. And they're going to be replacing that with administrative data, which is all of our interactions we have with the government. So, you know, when you sign up, you know, for your student allowance, that's recorded in administrative data. When you go to the emergency room, that's recorded in administrative data, and so on and so on and so on. So that's going to fill the gaps. And then another part of this whole idea is that there will be, from time to time, smaller surveys where they might survey a smaller percentage of the population rather than pretty much door-knocking everyone or sending out census forms to everyone. So that's the other thing there. We haven't had a lot of detail necessarily about what those surveys will look like. They have consulted with different, for example, LGBT groups and different ethnic communities, but we're not quite clear on what that will look like yet in practice.
Yeah, you mentioned a little bit the kinds of administrative data that the government will be using here. There's been some, I guess, vagueness around the term and what it might mean in practice. What kind of administrative data is the government collecting and what kind of picture does it paint about people?
Well, like I said before, every sort of interaction that you have with the government, you know, I think when you fill out a form, and some of my research looks at, you know, like the ethnicity box you fill out on a form or the iwi affiliation or Māori box that you fill out on the form, right? So every time you fill out a form, that form goes somewhere. And those forms, they're used, and obviously for the day-to-day practice of whatever government agency that is. So, like, you know, when you get arrested, the police, or, like, when you go to the hospital needs that record, and that's treated a different way, and in very different ways depending on the government agency. But some of those records do go to this, it's a set of integrated data infrastructure, which is a set of data sets that are linked together. Your identifying information is stripped away from it, so you don't necessarily have to worry about someone looking up, you know, your name and finding out all this information about you. But that database has been in operation since about 2011, where they started to link some tax data, and it's just kind of blossomed out and grown. And, you know, there's a lot of discussions about this thing called social license. That's where the public knows that this is happening and is kind of okay with it, you know, on a trade-off kind of day-to-day balance. Are they okay with it? That's the idea of social license. But a lot of people don't really know that the government is doing this and are not necessarily comfortable with it. So there's a lot of concerns around that. There's also concerns about surveillance. So, you know, we know that different companies, for example, Meta or Google, know a lot about us and kind of surveil us, send us ads or whatever it is. But the idea that the government is doing it makes a lot of people feel uncomfortable, and especially a lot of Māori feel uncomfortable given our history with the state.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about surveillance a bit later on, but I wanted to talk about now. You mentioned the concerns around the census and not reaching, I guess, Māori and Pacific communities. With this new use of administrative data and survey data, are there concerns that, you know, especially with rural Māori communities and rural Pacific communities, are there concerns that these communities could be further excluded from data collection?
Well, it really is. There's so many different factors involved here. So colleagues and I wrote a piece on behalf of some of the executive of Te Mana Rodonga, the Māori Data Sovereignty Network. And he thinks for us, you know, on balance, we can see the need to move away from something like the census. But what we really need in between is that proper engagement with communities to figure out how we will, as a sort of data system, how we will make sure that we have good data on these sort of intersectional communities is the best way I'd refer to them. So say you do a survey of 10,000 people, and it's a representative, high-quality survey. You put money in, you go door knocking, you do all of that. So 10,000 people, and, you know, latest estimates are around 16-17% of people are Māori. So then you're down to 1,600, say 1,700 people. And then say you want to look at LGBT, Māori, takatāpui, and then you're looking at maybe 10% of people. So see, the sample size gets smaller and smaller. And so that limits our ability to be able to have really robust, reliable data for sub-communities, for intersectionality, for different people. We all know we're all members of so many different social groups that have different policy needs. So that limits the ability for us to be able to zoom in on different communities in a way that we'd want to. The other thing with administrative data is it doesn't collect kind of data about well-being and who communities and people are in the same way that a good survey or a census does. So that's another limitation there. You know, when you're, that data is collected on you when you're like, you're down and out, you're at your most vulnerable, you know, you're having a terrible time for most of those data sets, you know, things like corrections, things like hospital data sets. So it doesn't let us necessarily paint the picture of our communities and the strengths of our communities in the way that we would hope that the data system would move to. Not that the census necessarily did that well, but it's kind of a missed opportunity there.
Yeah, and with that poor picture being painted, it seems like a good time to come back around to the surveillance data. Mm. How common is the collection of surveillance data, and is there a possibility of it being used, I guess, at the present but also after the census is scrapped?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we've heard over the years, many years with the census. There was the wizard in Christchurch that would always famously say, I'm not filling out the census, don't want the government knowing my information. And that's just been kind of a long-running theme, that people have been willing to, say, take the fine and not do the census because it has been compulsory. And we've seen, you know, falling response rates over the years. So that is one reason that people don't want to be part of the census. But what we've seen since 2011 with the integrated data infrastructure is the slow increase in administrative data being collected and being kind of pulled together in a way that a lot of people don't know about and are not comfortable with. Stats NZ did some survey research themselves and found that, you know, it's a minority of people that know that this is going on. And so can we really consent to this? The issue with it as well is that you can't opt out of government services. Like if you're at the hospital, they're collecting data on you. You can't be like, oh no, actually I'm going to treat this infection myself. You know, it's not, you can't really opt out. And for example, you're on the plane coming back from Australia and there's this little, you know, thing in the traveller declaration form saying your data are going to be used. You can't really be like, no, I'm not going to get off the plane. These are not really options for people. So that's where we're really, a lot of people are really concerned about this whole idea of surveillance. And we're seeing it as well pop up in America with this idea that there would be a linked database and the kind of outrage about the idea that anyone would link data across government agencies. But we've had that to some extent in New Zealand. So it is really like a bit of a freedom and a rights issue, but it also creates a lot of concerns for communities that are over-surveilled anyway, for Māori communities in particular. There's been different points in the government's sort of policy history, especially under that sort of Bill English, John Key government, where they discussed this idea of predictive risk modelling. So using some of these data points to try to see who would be more at risk or less at risk for, you know, future negative behaviour, and to try and target people with interventions. And that there's ways to do that, or ways to engage with communities to do that kind of idea well, to do social investment well, but there's also a lot of risks in those sorts of approaches where you start targeting people based on them being more expensive to the government. So there's a lot of kind of politics around that part of the equation too.
And did you have anything else you wanted to add?
I would just say that if anyone is interested in Māori data sovereignty, to follow Te Mana Roronga, the Māori Data Sovereignty Network. We're on LinkedIn, which is very corporate of us, but we also have a membership list. So we're going to keep kind of following these issues and looking at them from different Māori perspectives.
That was Associate Professor of Politics at Victoria University, Dr. Lara Greaves. You can find more information about Te Mana Roronga in this interview's BCast, which you can find on 95bfm.com later today.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Hanging out with the camera down my throat. They say my stomach's nearly fried from meat and cigarettes for breakfast. But if I follow 7 easy steps, I might avoid my death. The pyramid of health. So come on down, bring your sacrificial goat, and don't forget to wear your feathers and your silly little necklace. And get real high with the shrimp up in the sky, and you'll no longer fear your death. The pyramid of health. Stood on a mountain and I turned to dust. Little green worm said it wasn't enough, so he turned me back into a bag of meat. Gave me a liquid from a nearby tree. Said drink this sludge and you see what I mean. To a bag of meat. The pyramid of health is in everything. Hanging around in a desert on a boat. Some guy's yelling in my ear about eating cactuses for breakfast. And if I follow 7 easy steps, I'll see visions of my death. The pyramid of health. Stood on a mountain and I turned to dust. Little green worm said it wasn't enough, so he turned me back into a bag of meat. Gave me a liquor from a nearby tree. Said drink this sludge and you'll see what I mean. The pyramid of health is in everything. So I looked up in the sky and I saw it clear. Stood on the mountain and I turned to dust.
95. BFM.
Did you know?
What a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Although 65 is still New Zealand's retirement age, there has recently been an increase in over 65s in the workforce for a number of reasons. Researchers such as Nush Herman from the co-created Aging Research Centre believe that having older adults in the workplace should be normalised. I spoke to Nush about ageism and breaking the stigma around over 65s still working.
Why should we normalise older adults, let's say those above retirement age, in the workplace?
I think this, it's not really accurate to think that older adults in the workplace aren't a normal part of the workplace. With more people that are growing older and they're in good health, many people want to stay in the workplace or need to stay in the workplace. There really isn't a fixed point where you would consider that old age sets in and people should be retired by that age.
What age-based discrimination do older adults in the workplace face?
There are all sorts of discriminations. I think technology is probably one of the most prevalent people thinking that older people aren't as tech savvy, or that people should make way for younger people to move into more senior positions. But if we look at the latest statistics in New Zealand, there has been an increase in the percentage of adults aged over 65 that are in full or part-time employment. This has increased, I think, to 24.1% in the last census. And the largest increase in people staying in the workplace is people aged 70 to 74. So that's up nearly 3% in 10 years.
And if this has become a more recent trend, does this say anything about the economic or socio-political state of the country?
I think it does. Certainly with declining birth rates and an increasingly older population, you would want people to stay in the workplace as long as possible because you don't have as big a tax income from younger contributors.
Do you think that laws around superannuation should be different for over 65 still in the workforce?
That's something that in the New Zealand context I'm not as familiar. I've been in New Zealand for 2 years, so I'm very familiar with the context back in Australia. In New Zealand, people can access a pension at 65, but also the superannuation contributions have been anywhere between 3% and upwards of what people want to contribute, whereas I'm familiar with the Australian context where it has been 9% for some years and has just been increased to 12%. That obviously gives people a much bigger savings as they move into their retirement.
And before we wrap up the interview, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yes, we've got a panel session on here at the centre tomorrow on ageism. And so there'll be a number of speakers talking about a variety of different issues to do with ageism. And if we can counter those ageist attitudes, not only towards older people, but it also does affect a lot of younger people as well, and erodes their well-being. There's research from the World Health Organization around ageism being associated with an earlier death, 7.5 years, and poorer physical and mental health. So it's important that we move more towards intergenerational connections, normalise people, whatever age they are, being in the workforce. And that's a really positive thing for society.
That was Nush Herman about breaking the stigma around having older adults in the workplace.
That was The Wire.
Ka ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Dr. Kushla McGovern, the National Party's Tom Rutherford, Associate Professor of Politics at Victoria University, Dr. Lara Greaves, and researcher from the co-created Ageing Research Centre, Nush Herman. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Jin.
Radio.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.